Not many education books debut as a New York Times bestseller, but The Teacher Wars by Dana Goldstein is not just any book. A history of America's most embattled profession, it serves as a tonic to reformers who believe we are the first ones to discover problems with America's public schools or to call for policies such as tenure reform, merit pay, or higher standards for entry into the profession. With sympathy for teachers, but also clear eyes about the profession's legitimate shortcomings, Goldstein has produced a book that will challenge defenders of the public education system and reformers alike. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Yeah, congrats on the book's phenomenal reception. What do you make of that? New York Times bestseller. It's a history book.
Wow. Well, it was funny because when I was a 27-year-old journalist 4 years ago, first pitching this project, people said, why do you want to write a history and no one cares about the past? And maybe you could spend a year shadowing a Teach for America teacher. And I said, I really have this vision for this and I want to do this. And I was lucky to find an editor and a publisher who wanted to, you know, take this risk on me. And I'm just very happy that people do, it turns out, want to hear these stories from the past.
Yeah, no, and it's so powerful because, of course, we need to understand that reform is not something that is new. It's been going on for 150 years. All right, let's start. We're going to start with some of the provocative statements that you make in the book, and then we'll get into some of the history. And I'd just like you to kind of respond to this. You say, quote, public school teaching has become the most controversial profession in America. What is your evidence for that, and why do you think that's the case?
Well, when we saw the recession hit in late 2008 and then coming into the Obama administration in 2009, we had this crisis around unemployment, and we were talking about socioeconomic inequality. And again, I saw that it was public school teachers who were being tasked politically with helping us to solve this crisis, to the point that, again and again, President Obama in his State of the Union addresses, teaching would be the one profession, the one sort of job category that he would call out as needing to do a better job. And so to me, it was so unquestioning. I mean, I just saw so clearly that teaching was this source of controversy and no other job was getting this political focus.
Even other jobs that are very much public jobs, like cops that are paid for by the public that do a public service.
Yeah. And we're talking here in fall 2014, and now we're focusing so much on policing with the Ferguson controversy. And so that, I think, complicates maybe some of the argument I make in the book, because now I feel like we are starting a national conversation about policing that we, you know, maybe didn't have in 2011 when I started writing this book.
It's novel. It's new. I mean, it hasn't happened. Now, that's interesting. But you also say this. It says, you say, even as we were obsessed with the very worst teachers, we were worshiping an ideal superhuman few. So there's this dichotomy. I mean, there's all this talk about these terrible teachers. You say it's kind of like today's welfare queen, right? And people putting all this blame on these tenured teachers who are collecting pensions and not helping kids learn. On the other hand, you have people talking about the power of these teachers to transform lives and to help children climb the ladder to the middle class.
Right. And this dual rhetoric, what I write in the book is that it causes whiplash because you have angel teachers on one hand and these devil teachers on the other hand. And I really thought about when I had the chance in early 2009, Arne Duncan was our brand new Secretary of Education. I was interviewing him and someone said to him, what do you think makes a great teacher? And he got quiet for a second. He said, well, a great teacher is a miracle worker. A great teacher walks on water. Mm-hmm. And I have just always remembered that instead of, you know, talking specifically about what a great teacher does in the classroom or something. Something real, he came up with this fantasy image of an effective educator.
Right, right. Unfortunately, then there's not that many of them, right? There was only one Jesus and 12 disciples. So there you go, right? That's not enough to staff American schools. All right, one more. You quote John Dewey back from 1895 saying, education is and forever will be in the hands of ordinary men and women.
Yeah. And I think the reason why that quote stuck out at me and I begin the book with that quote is because we have 3.4 million American public school teachers. So sometimes when people go, oh, their SAT scores are just about average, their GPAs are just about average, my response is, well, there's 3.4 million of them. There's regression to the mean.
Right.
Whenever you have this many people doing something, you're going to need it to be a job that can be done by an ordinary person, an ordinary college graduate. Teachers have more education than the average American, so we should be clear about that. But, you know, we can't just easily replace huge numbers of teachers because we need so many teachers.
Yeah, very good. All right, well, let's get into some of the history. We'll get back to some of these, that what this means for today's education reform debates, but let's dig in a bit. I would love to have you tell us about some of these fascinating men and women and some of the great stories. So let's start with Catherine Beecher and Horace Mann. I joked earlier on Twitter that they were American education's first power couple, but they did not ever actually get together. But they were close, and they worked together on many issues.
Yeah, so they first meet in their early 20s, and Catherine Beecher is a young sort of girls finishing school teacher at the time, and she's the daughter of Lyman Beecher, the Calvinist fire and brimstone celebrity preacher. She's the sister of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. She comes from this incredibly intellectual family where girls are encouraged to have opinions and debate political ideas. So when she meets Horace Mann, who is a young law student in Connecticut with political ambitions, he is wowed by her. He has never met a young woman who is so conversant in ideas. And they fall into a conversation at a party. And he writes to his sister afterward, "Gosh, I really regret that she's engaged to another man."
And soon thereafter, that man dies in a shipwreck. Yes. I find this suspicious.
Well, it was off the coast of Ireland, so he was far, far away from Horace Mann. So he dies, and this event, this guy, Alexander Fisher, dying, actually is transformative for American education, because what happens is Catherine Beecher says to herself, "I would like to do something useful with my life, and it doesn't look like I'm going to get married like I plan to." And she puts an argument out there in the public sphere, kind of going around the country's election. Sure, I call her America's first media darling school reformer. You know, maybe we could think of her as the Michelle Rhee of her day. But she goes from place to place making this argument that we should allow women to teach in schools. And to us today, that's like, duh, women are most teachers. But back then, actually, women were often governesses in private people's homes. But public schools were taught by men. 90% of school teachers were men. So she's making a quite radical argument. And Horace Mann, who gets very interested in education policy when he goes to the Massachusetts state legislature, he says, "Wow, this is a great idea, because I would like common schooling. I would like public schools for all kids. I would like to tell parents that by law you're required to send your child to school. This sounds kind of expensive. We're going to open a whole lot of new schools. And I know that my more conservative peers in the state legislature do not want to raise taxes. So I see Catherine Beecher, who I knew back in the day when we were young kids, she's making this beautiful sort of idealistic argument about female educators. I would like to take that argument and also echo that, because I know I can pay female teachers half as much." So he goes, he asks for $2 million to start schools. The legislature gives him $1 million. He decides that the teachers are going to be women, unsurprisingly.
So because they are cheaper. Now, so tell us more, though, about Catherine's argument then. What was her romantic or idealistic argument for why women should be teachers rather than men?
Well, she wasn't a feminist, which is interesting. She did not support women's right to vote. She saw teaching as something women were biologically suited for. Mm-hmm. It was mothering at school instead of in the home.
Right.
So she makes the argument that women are more moral and that we should be giving our children a moral education. This really appeals to Horace Mann. One thing both of them are very concerned about is Catholic immigration to the United States at the time. Mm. And they want to make sure that these Catholic children are getting the right Protestant WASP values. And they see that women teachers will be sort of the folks that impart these Protestant values on the immigrant children.
And they couldn't trust the men to do it because the men were a bunch of drunks and...
Yeah, that's what they say. It's not actually true. If you look at local people who wrote at the time about their teachers, a lot of people were very happy with their local male educators, but they portray men as lash wielding, intemperate, meaning that they're alcoholic at the time.
Yeah.
The idea that they were almost abusive toward kids. And we have a great literary figure, Ichabod Crane from Washington Irving's Legend of Sleepy Hollow, who epitomizes this type. And we think of it as a ghost story, but if you go back and read it with your adult hat on, you'll see it's a satire about a very simple-minded school teacher who is really quite stupid. And this was the popular image of the
that
male
was the
teacher.
Image. Yeah, interesting. So tell us some about the phrenology movement, because this is interesting. It kind of has some echoes that come up later. What was this all about?
Well, phrenology was a bizarre and problematic pseudoscience that was popular in the 19th century in the United States that posited that by, you know, feeling the bumps on a person's head, you could draw conclusions about their moral and intellectual worth. And this was supposed to be able to tell you if a child might be predestined toward crime. Mm-hmm. And so Horace Mann is incredibly fascinated by this ideology. He even names his son after George Combe, the Scottish phrenologist. But interestingly, although it is so problematic with our contemporary view, especially because, of course, they thought people of color and immigrants had more bumps on their heads and were therefore more likely to be criminals and all these other things, it was kind of progressive at the time, because what Horace Mann believed is that, you know, once you use the bumps to identify the kid's shortcomings, you could put this kid in school and you could help him avoid this fate.
So it's the beginning of this idea that education can be the cure to some of our social ills.
Exactly.
In this case, crime.
Yes, that's exactly how he thought about it. And he was really, Horseman was also really involved in the asylum movement for mentally ill people. All of these things were motivated by fear of crime, which is really interesting.
And probably as the country is becoming more urbanized, as people are moving to the cities. So Susan B. Anthony, she comes into the story as many famous people in your book as a teacher, and then goes on to do other things. Tell us about her role in education.
So dating back to her teenage years, she is a young woman who realizes that marriage is just not for her. And she also comes from a family that is experiencing downward mobility economically. Her father's business goes bust. So what's she going to do? She's going to do the only job that she can do, as defined by the generation before her, Horace Mann and Catherine Beecher. She becomes a school teacher. And in her late 20s, she has about 10 years of experience. She's had some success in the classroom. And a 19-year-old boy is promoted above her to be the principal of the school. And she is so frustrated because she wants that job. And she is broke. And she is living in this cold room in a relative's home. She can't even get her own home. It's very frustrating for her. And this is one of the things that happens to her in her life that motivates her into feminist activism. You know, she's getting paid half as much. She can't be promoted. And she is one of many female teachers who, beginning in the mid-19th century, are quite angry that this profession has, they've been told, this is all you can do. And if you do it, you're going to get paid less.
And you're going to have these younger, less qualified men be put in positions of authority over you. And so then, you know, she starts all kinds of activism, which, you know, it seems like you kind of draw a line between her activism, and eventually we end up with what's today the teacher unions, right?
Absolutely. So she's traveling all over New York State, sort of proto-union organizing. There's a big male-female pay gap, and she succeeds in getting even some male teachers to pass some resolutions that don't really go anywhere, saying, you know, we, the teachers of New York State, do swear that this is not fair. But it doesn't, nothing really happens with it, in part because the Civil War interrupts this movement. And, you know, Susan B. Anthony was not as astute in terms of labor politics as some of the women who came after her. She actually strike broke at several points in her career in her efforts to use strikes to get women workers to take the jobs that had been held by men, not in education, but in other fields. She's not that great reaching out to blue collar organized labor. However, by 1897, there's a new generation of women school teachers who do organize themselves into what becomes today's teachers union movement. And they are the sisters and the daughters of men who work in the manufacturing economy and are unionized, and they are successful using that model in unionizing themselves.
Right. Okay. We're going to get to that. You mentioned the Civil War. Right after the Civil War, or maybe it was even during the Civil War, you tell me, the Port Royal experiment.
During the war, actually. Yeah. So the Union Army took the Sea Islands off the coast of the Carolinas.
Yeah. This includes Hilton Head. I have a family down there myself. Spent a lot of time down there.
Probably reminds people of golf today.
Yes, exactly.
But what happens is that the union decides, with some pressure on them from philanthropists, they're going to try a kind of radical experiment. They're going to turn the land over to the slaves and see what happens, and they're going to provide an education. And so I talk about Charlotte Fortin, who's this extraordinary young Black woman. She is a Black woman born free to a rich family in Philadelphia. And she travels down there. It's her first look at the South. She's had her entire life in the North. And she teaches these children of slaves. Actually, the kids themselves had been slaves just a few months earlier. And she has what is for her a shocking experience. There's, you know, no sanitation. The kids have never sat still before. They've been doing physical labor. So her challenge as a teacher is really to introduce them to what a classroom even is.
Mm-hmm. And what's the goal here? I mean, the bigger goal for the experiment was that the slaves would take ownership and run these plantations. But what was the vision for the children? Were they being trained to work on these plantations, or were they going to go, you know, with the idea to have opportunity to do other things? What was that all about?
The vision was of a moral education, mm-hmm. actually. You know, the idea that in slavery, the morality of the Black race was not developed, and that these teachers were going to fix that problem. It wasn't really a rigorous academic vision.
Or even vocational,
yeah. Yes. Actually, the slave children and their parents continued to harvest the cotton. Mm-hmm. And then what happened is that President Johnson gave the land back to the former Confederates. Mm-hmm. And that is what happened to so many of the progressive social experiments in the South after the Civil War.
That eventually during Reconstruction, they just gave up on these experiments.
They gave up on it. And, you know, those children became sharecroppers is what actually happened to them.
Right. And over time, of course, if they were getting any education, it was terribly funded. And this leads to Plessy and on and on. You, of course, get into Du Bois versus Booker T. Washington. You know, I think most people familiar with education understand some of their debates around the talented 10th versus, you know, liberal arts education, at least for some, versus vocational education. But you talk about how they also had very strong debates about teacher training and mm-hmm. what that should look like.
Yeah, I'm glad you zeroed in on that. One of their interesting similarities, actually, is that both men, Du Bois and Washington, believe in this missionary teacher ideal. They believe mm-hmm. teaching is the highest calling. Du Bois says it's the preacher and the teacher. These two figures represent all the hopes of the Black community in the decades after the Civil War. So it's a very reformy, as we would say it today,
yes,
you know, very idealistic vision and, you know, very inspiring. And mm-hmm. they inspire young Black educators from the North to go South and to do this. And so it's quite wonderful, these stories. What they disagreed about is that Du Bois had this concept of the talented 10th, the 10% of Black people who would get a liberal arts education and go to four-year colleges. And he believes teachers are in that group.
Yep.
And Booker T. Washington says, not necessarily. It's fine if they have the equivalent of a middle school education, because what we really need is for them to be going out and opening more schools. We need more schools. I mean, you have to remember, it was illegal to teach a Black person to read in the South before the Civil War.
And there's very little money available.
Right. There's no money. There's no system.
Right.
So, you know, you can see the pragmatic argument that Washington was making. And in fact, his Tuskegee Institute opens all of these Black Belt rural schools for Black kids in the South. And also the people who graduate from there go on to open normal schools that mm-hmm. teach Black teachers. Well, what was Tuskegee teaching? It was teaching the equivalent of about 7th, 8th grade education.
Yeah.
This truly made Du Bois uncomfortable. You know, he wrote that the teacher who teaches Black kids needs to be able to open their eyes to the wider world. Mm-hmm. He says they need to acquaint the child with white ways. And he doesn't think that these sort of more lowly educated folks are going to be able to do that.
Yeah. And here we are still debating these normal schools, now called education schools, right?
Yes,
and whether they have high enough standards.
The old normal schools really do transition into lots of today's teachers' colleges, you know, by about the 1950s.
Yeah. Maggie Haley. Tell us about this fighting Irish woman, Maggie Haley.
She's a tiny little sprite. She is a feminist teacher. She is one of the founders of the Teachers Union, 1897, Chicago. Mm-hmm. She is the daughter of an Irish immigrant who built the Illinois-Michigan Canal. Mm. She grows up real working class and becomes a teacher. And what teachers are really angry about in Chicago in 1897 is that 97% of the teachers were female, and there begins to be a reform conversation at that time that this is a problem and mm-hmm. we need to get more men into the classroom. And the way they want to do it is basically, let's pay women less, decrease their salary so that we can attract more men.
And so we could pay the men more?
Exactly. That was the idea. And a bunch of states are experimenting with that. Massachusetts was one of the mm-hmm. early ones that had tried it. You know, interestingly, they were at the forefront of feminization and then at the forefront mm-hmm. of getting worried that now there were too many female teachers. The concern about female teachers in 1897 had a lot to do with the immigration that was going on. There were 60 and 70 kid classrooms. Kids were coming from Ireland, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Italy. They were speaking every language, and there was a lot of truancy. And kids were working in the factories, and then getting pulled by the truant officers into the classroom. And these were wild kids. They weren't behaving well. Mm-hmm. And the reformers, the male reformers, like Nicholas Murray Butler, one of the founders of Teachers College up at Columbia, they were saying, women can't handle this. Women do not have the balls to do this job. So we have to, again, we're conscious that a lot of our allies don't want their taxes to be raised. Mm-hmm. Let's decrease the female teachers' pay and get the men in here.
Right. Right. No, it's and of course, you think back now today, you're like, I don't know who anybody who could handle 60 kids in a classroom, particularly tough kids from used to working in the factories. I mean, this is hard.
It's really absurd. And one of the interesting things is going back to read the muckraking journalism produced during the progressive era about schools. The whole class size issue was sort of off the radar.
Yeah.
I mean,
they just assumed that's how it was.
Yeah, it was sometimes mentioned, but teachers' unions were angry about these class sizes and they were talking about it, but the media was not too attuned to this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, interesting. All right. You skip ahead. Well, I'm going to skip ahead to the war period and the loyalty oaths. What was that all about?
So from about World War One all the way till 1960, we see these waves of Red Scares and teachers with either pacifist or Quaker or socialist or communist beliefs are caught up in these witch hunts to get left-wing educators out of the classroom. And in New York City and in a lot of other places, you see an actual oath being presented to the teacher and them being asked either to sign their name to it. You know, I pledge loyalty to the United States government in its war against the imperial power of Germany. That's the text of one of the ones that I look at in the book. So either the teacher has to sign or they have to raise their right hand and pledge this. And unsurprisingly, hundreds of teachers initially say, I'm not all that comfortable with this. I don't want to do it. But when they realize they're going to lose their jobs, the vast majority say, oh, fine, I'm going to sign this thing.
Right.
Some of them don't. Some of them are Quakers, and it's a religious belief for them that they don't support war. And in fact, they are put on trial, these show trials. They lose their jobs. And one of the stories I tell in Chapter 5 is a lot of the teachers who were victimized by these witch hunts were excellent educators. I mean, they were far out ahead of the debates at the time. They really were concerned about achievement gaps and rigorous standards for poor children in a way that the rest of the educational debate was kind of stuck in this sort of IQ testing fervor at the time, very interested in kind of gearing poor children toward vocational ed or general education and not preparing them for college. So it's a sad chapter, unfortunately.
So, I mean, you could only imagine it would be strange today, right? We would ask teachers to pledge their allegiance to in the fight against global terrorism or something like that.
You know, it's unthinkable.
and we, you know, sometimes scoff when critics of the Common Core, for example, talk about it being Commie Core or, but at the same time, Dana, like back then, you know, this was a scary time and these were serious threats. And you had people like, you know, had Adolf Hitler out there, you know, trying to do all kinds of terrible things. Some of these teachers, I mean, it was true that they believed in overthrowing the Constitution.
And absolutely.
I mean, so at the same time, you can have some sympathy for the people who thought, hey, you know, they should pledge themselves at least to defend our system of government.
Yeah, I try to not romanticize this in the book. And I mean, readers can tell me how successful I was at that or not successful. But I tried to show that, you know, these people had truly radical politics. And just because some of them were effective educators and were doing wonderful things in the classroom with their kids doesn't mean that they didn't have like onerous politics. I mean, you flip through the newspaper of the teachers union, which was the communist union in New York City from the 30s through about 1960. And there's these very bizarre depictions of the ideal education, which is supposedly being offered in the Soviet Union. Yeah. And it is really disturbing.
Yeah. All right. Skipping ahead again, we get to the 60s and you dig in a bit to President Lyndon B. Johnson's time as a teacher, which he made a lot of out of, even though it was only 9 months long.
Right. That's right. The reason why he becomes a teacher is because he's in love with this girlfriend of his and she wants to become a teacher in South Texas on the Mexico border. And so she says she's going to do it. And so he says, oh, I'm going to look for a neighboring district. I'm also going to get a teaching job. So he goes down there. He's 21. He hasn't finished college yet. He's kind of taken a break. And they immediately make him principal of this school because he's a guy. Oh, my gosh, there's a man who wants to be here. So it's kind of echoes of Susan B. Anthony 80 years later. And he actually, I think, was of all the teachers I wrote about in this book, I would have liked to visit his classroom the most, because on one hand, he's like practicing corporal punishment with these Mexican-American children and doing all sorts of terrible things, like, you know, hitting them if they dare to speak Spanish in front of him. Hmm. But on the other hand, he's, you know, singing them a song every morning about how they can dream to be president and go to college. And he is giving them quite a rigorous education. He actually sets up a debate society for them, after school sports. Mm-hmm. This is a very, very poor village that he's in, Cotola, Texas. And he has to write home to his mom, you know, "Dear mom, please send toothpaste," because the kids really have nothing. So when I looked at him as president, I was interested in how he framed this, you know, short but important period of his own life. And he used it to argue not just for ESEA, for, you know, federal education funding, but also for Head Start and Medicaid and every other War on Poverty Great Society program, because he felt that his experience as a teacher not only awakened him to the powerful role of the teacher, which he truly believed in, but also to all the other things poor children need to excel.
Yeah, the broader, bolder agenda, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you could say he was an early broader, bolder signatory.
Absolutely. So a lot of idealism, of course, in the early and mid-60s, a lot of talk about education being the passport out of poverty. Also the beginning of the Teacher Corps. And tell us about that, but also about the earlier Board of National Popular Education. This seems familiar to perhaps an organization we know today called Teach for America.
Yes, I call them both proto Teach for Americas in the book. So we talked about Catherine Beecher and her image of women getting into teaching, and the Board of National Popular Education is her effort to do that, to recruit these, you know, young WASPy girls from the East Coast and bring them west to open frontier schoolhouses. Mm. Guess how many weeks of training they get over the summer before they do it?
Six?
Five, just like now.
That's amazing.
Literally the same 5 weeks. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was so stunning to me when I found that out. So yeah, she did it. She did it in the 19th century. And then, you know, moving forward to the 1960s, we see the National Teacher Corps get started. And it's based on a couple programs that are already existing across the country. One is the Cardozo Project. We're here in Washington, D.C. today. It starts here at Cardozo High School up in Columbia Heights. And that started under the Kennedy years. Joan Wofford, a young teacher, began that. And the president, President Johnson, is very interested, and he works to scale this up into the National Teacher Corps. It is a lot like Teach for America. It's all about getting elite young college grads to teach for a couple years. Yeah. But it has this feisty left-wing kind of activist-y thing that Teach for America doesn't have. Mm-hmm. It requires them to live in the poor neighborhoods where they're working. It asks them to do community service outside the classroom. So you see these young teacher corps teachers, some of them getting involved in tenant organizing, stuff that's completely far afield from the academic mission. Mm-hmm. And unsurprisingly, it's totally unsustainable. They're completely exhausted. There's no way that they can teach all day and then, you know, go out, do tenant organizing at night. The set of expectations is not all that realistic. And also the unions hate this program. I mean, it sounds to us today so lefty, and, you know, maybe the unions like this one more than Teach for America because, you know, there was no Walton Foundation funding. Nope, they didn't like it. It was a big federal program, totally government funded, and the unions did not like it. They saw it as a threat to their status.
Right, that it was still the same complaint that is about short timers. That it's about,
they said the NEA said this is deprofessionalizing us.
Yeah, interesting. Well, this idealism of the early mid-60s, it gives way, at least in many cities like New York, to a real struggle between the Black Power movement and the teacher unions. Folks may have read about some of this in Rick Kahlenberg's book on Al Shanker or Diane Ravitch's book on the education wars, but you dig into this as well. Tell us a little bit about what is going on. You're pitting teachers, many of them women now, many of them Jewish, against the Black Power movement.
Yes. So what happens in New York is that there begin to be calls within the Black community inspired by the Black Power rhetoric coming from figures like Stokely Carmichael and Amiri Baraka. There begin to be calls, you know, to just get these white bureaucracies, these unions, these school boards, this mayor, just get them out of our business. Like, we want to elect our own school board and just hire Black administrators, Black teachers, and do this ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, 2/3 of the teachers are white Jewish in neighborhoods like Ocean Hill-Brownsville, which becomes the locus of this fight, and the place where the largest teacher strike in American history begins. It's in central Brooklyn, actually not far from where I live now. The Ford Foundation is funding these radical requests. Mm-hmm. It is allied with the Black Power movement on one side, and on the other side, white philanthropy, liberal mm-hmm. philanthropy is coming in to provide the money. And what happens when the Black administration gets the permission from Mayor Lindsay to experiment in this way? Now, he wants to do it because he doesn't want to be asked to bus the kids. Okay. So this is an alternative for him he finds better politically.
Right.
So when the Black administration takes over, they, you know, start firing white teachers, and the union is incensed. You know, they have only had collective bargaining for less than a decade at this mm-hmm. point. And they hate the idea that they would have to negotiate, you know, teacher contracts and teacher rights with each individual mm-hmm. little neighborhood in New York City. You know, they like a big centralized system that suits them.
Right. And you have these race-based firings, right? I mean, this is, of course, they're going to protect the teachers who have their jobs and try to keep them from getting fired.
Yeah. I tried to look pretty closely at the 20 teachers who were let go. And that's something that I wanted this book to do, and actually mm-hmm. ask the question if they were good teachers beyond the fact that they were just white. And there had been some interesting kind of oral histories and things that I dug up actually trying to look at this question, which was more debated back then than it mm-hmm. has been in recent decades when mm-hmm. we talk about this incident. You know, some of the teachers were awful. I talk about this art teacher, Richard Douglas, who, you know, it was just a regular occurrence that kids were throwing paint at each other. Nothing was mm-hmm. happening in his class. And when he was asked why, he said, "Oh, I believe in the Summerhill ideology." Now, this is a boarding school in England is a quote unquote free school. Wasn't working in Central Brooklyn. It's not what the parents wanted. They were asking for stricter mm-hmm. discipline and more structure. And, you know, this white teacher, he just simply had an ideological feeling against more structure. And also, he did not have the skills to provide structure.
That's interesting.
Bad teacher. There was a couple others like that. Some of them were great, though.
Yeah.
One guy was targeted because he kind of badmouthed community control, Black power, mm-hmm. educational theories at a Christmas party. However, he was a good social studies teacher. You know, parents liked him. Mm-hmm. He had a record of success. So it was a mixed bag.
And you can start to see that this is a bit of a precursor to today's voucher movements, to some of the charter school, at least rhetoric about community control, right?
Definitely.
And so that is kind of a straight line there as well.
I think the straightest line is to parent trigger efforts, because as you had philanthropists, you know, back then coming in and saying we're going to have community control, that's kind of what we're seeing in some places with parent trigger today.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me have you respond to a few more statements. This one is from a review of your book from The New Yorker, which, by the way, congratulations. That's pretty cool
to get
a blurb in The New Yorker. It says that you assert that, quote, the common force behind each new wave of school reforms is evangelical conviction, and that the new movements often seem more based on faith than on factual evidence. Do you think that's still true today? Is that true of today's education reform movement, more based on faith than factual evidence?
I think this was a perceptive reading of the history. I feel, and I began covering education in 2006, mm-hmm. one of the things that annoyed me as a journalist back then is that I felt that there was more faith than fact mm-hmm. in the debate. Like, mm-hmm. there was this picture of all charter schools, 100% of all charter schools are the best.
Yep.
And the charter school movement is the savior of public education. I see in 2014 a much more nuanced debate. Mm-hmm. I see more acknowledgement like, the best charter schools are some of the best schools we have. However, there's a lot mm-hmm. of average and underperforming ones as well. And we in the charter movement are acknowledging that mm-hmm. and would like to, you know, address our own quality issues. I'm characterizing, you know, the charter sector.
Sure.
I'm not myself a member of the charter sector. But I think that the current debate is more nuanced mm-hmm. than it even was 10 years ago.
And of course, you've written a long article drawn from the book for Vox about Teach for America and how it's trying to look at data to get better and smarter about how it does its work.
Absolutely. And they're a perfect example of an organization that I think began with a lot of big ideas about what would work and now has come to a place and has evolved to a place over the entirety of their history of being data-driven, evidence-driven, even to the point of questioning their own founding assumptions, which is something I give them a ton of credit for. Yeah. And I would say that their evolution echoes what's going on in the reform community more broadly.
Yeah. So one more quote then. The New Yorker also says, her ability to illuminate each new wave's hype disillusionment cycle is a welcome treatment of a fraught subject. So I don't know. Are you optimistic that maybe we will find our way out of that hype disillusionment cycle with this more nuanced, realistic approach?
Yeah. When I write about hype disillusionment in the book, I'm talking about ideas like, you know, these very mechanistic merit pay programs that require mm-hmm. a ton of paperwork. You know, they don't work. Administrators yeah. don't want all this paperwork.
The prescriptive teacher evaluations.
Yes, prescriptive yeah. teacher evaluations. They're too top down. You know, they don't provide flexibility for different student populations. We try them again and again over the decades and they don't work. So this is what I was thinking about when I wrote about hype disillusionment. I'm optimistic at this moment because when you see someone like Arnie Duncan making a statement as of a couple of weeks ago that this huge push on accountability tied to test scores is quote unquote sucking the oxygen out of the room. Mm-hmm. Now his administration's own policies have pushed
yes.
these accountability measures. So for him to have that moment of publicly saying, you know, maybe we push too hard, too fast on this, mm-hmm. that opens up the conversation. And I think that the reform movement and the media actually opened it up for him a little mm-hmm. bit first. And he's a laggard in a way to that. But I think we're in a moment where we say, look, since 2001, No Child Left Behind, we have pushed very hard on testing. We got a lot of great data from that, mm-hmm. and we see where the problems are. Let's take a step back. And I think now we're talking more about instructional excellence, so the actual stuff of education, which is the interactions between teacher and student in the classroom.
Yep.
That's where I end this book, looking at that, because, you know, truly we have never as a country focused on that part of the mm-hmm. equation. We've been more interested in the big level system and the big politics, right. but we have an incredibly decentralized system. You know, yeah. this is our American government. It is decentralized, and mm-hmm. you can't have an education reform movement that rails against what is.
Mm-hmm. And now we're having debates about things like close reading rather than just about these big superstructures.
Yeah.
Well, that we have just barely scratched the surface. It is a big book, an important book, in my view, a great book. People should check out many more fascinating characters and stories from history, you know, really pointing to this message that it is important for us who are working, do this work every day, that we understand that those that came before us and might learn something from their mistakes and their successes as well. So again, the book is The Teacher Wars. It's by Dana Goldstein, the subtitle, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. It is in bookstores. You should be able to find it where they sell the New York Times bestsellers. Congratulations again for that. Dana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike. This was a pleasure.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.